Good morning, everyone. Our first case today is Appeal 071474, and it's Comdisco versus Hughes. And it's Mr. Alsterda. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is John Alsterda. I'm counsel for the appellants, designated in our briefs as the SIP claimants. These were the 44 individuals who participated in the Comdisco Shared Investment Plan, along with the appellants Philip A. Hughes, John Voski, and Jack Slevin. By agreement, I will be arguing this morning on behalf of all of the appellants. Cases before the court on appeal from the order of the district court affirming the order of the bankruptcy court, which denied our motion to terminate the Comdisco Litigation Trust. The trust was established under Comdisco's plan of reorganization to pursue claims on behalf of unsecured Class C-4 creditors for amounts allegedly due by the appellants in connection with the SIP program.
Could I just ask you something very quickly?
Yes, Judge.
If we find in your favor, what would happen with the 67 cases that are being litigated in the district court and in the circuit court of Cook County?
Your Honor, if you were to find in our favor and direct that the bankruptcy court terminate the litigation trust, in our view, that would bring an end to all of the litigation that is now pending in all of the courts in relation to the SIP program. With the trust no longer being in existence, the causes of action could no longer proceed in the state and federal courts.
So your clients would receive a windfall then because they signed promissory notes and they would not have to pay on those promissory notes.
Your Honor, you are correct that they would not have to pay on the promissory notes. We do not believe that they would receive a windfall.
Why not? Yeah. If you sign a promissory note to pay, you know, $1,000 and then somebody says you don't have to pay that $1,000, why isn't that a windfall?
Your Honor, because in this particular circumstance, given the nature and structure of the SIP program, the appellants did not receive anything of substantial and concrete value when they participated in the plan.
Well, that was just a risk they took. They signed these notes. They were hoping that they'd get stock for the notes and that the stock would appreciate and life would be happy, but the stock didn't appreciate and Comdisco went into bankruptcy. But they signed these notes, and it seems to me very odd for you to be here arguing that they should be relieved of their obligation to pay on notes that they signed.
Your Honor, I think the key distinction is that if you or I were to sign a promissory note for $1,000 and we voluntarily, for whatever reason, chose not to repay that obligation and went into default and the amount is accelerated, yes, if we were relieved of that obligation, it might be viewed as a windfall. Here, however, what happened very clearly, and it's undisputed, is that Comdisco's bankruptcy filing was the event of default that triggered the obligation coming due and being accelerated in the full amount, in many instances in excess of $1 million. Appellants were not the ones who voluntarily chose not to repay this obligation.
I'd like to try and get to the bottom line of your argument. It seems that the trustee still has valid claims against the SIP, may I call them SIP?
Yes.
claimants. But the appellants are arguing that the trustee may not litigate those claims because the beneficiaries of the trust have already received everything they're due. Am I right so far?
Yes.
So if the C-4 creditors had not yet received full recoveries, could the trustee proceed with those claims against the SIP claimants?
Yes, I think it would be fair to say that had full recovery not occurred, the plan would provide and the bankruptcy code would allow for the trust litigation to proceed. What's key to our argument, Your Honor, is the bankruptcy court's finding in the confirmation order at paragraph AA that no creditors in this Class C-4, the general unsecured creditors, would be receiving more than full payment.
But this is a very unique definition of full payment, as your opponents point out, because as part of this overall, I'll call it a settlement, they agreed to forego their claims for interest. That's one point that's concerned me. And the other thing that concerns me is ex ante, at the time the bankruptcy court was evaluating all of this, the predictions were something from 85 to 90% would be recovered. In fact, more was, so much the better. But there was a give and take here. And I don't hear you saying that if you actually put interest back into the equation, that there's been excessive recovery.
Well, I think, Your Honor, on the first point, the plan itself does not allow for interest. You're correct. But
under the law, they could have insisted on interest.
They could have insisted upon interest, but what the C4 creditors did receive, however, is the present value payment on their claims. In other words, the time value of money, the time period during which they had to wait to receive 100% payment, was compensated by way of an interest factor. If I had a claim for $1,000, and as part of the Comdisco bankruptcy, I had to wait 2 years to get that $1,000, I was compensated for that time value of money on a present value basis. I probably received $1,100 or $1,050.
I may be missing something here, but what meaning do you suggest then that we give that provision in the distribution agreement that says that after the present value of distribution to creditors equals or exceeds, it says exceeds 100% of the allowed claims in Class C-4, which is the 100% recovery threshold, the holder of the CDR rights would then be entitled to receive new common shares or cash equal to that 37% of all distribution to creditors, and again, it says, in excess of such 100% recovery. That seems to pretty clearly contemplate that some creditors are going to receive more than 100%, including the C4 creditors. I mean, why wasn't there some objection to this plan before it was confirmed if there was a problem with the language? I mean,
Your Honor, I believe in the first instance it's important in evaluating how the plan treats the various creditor constituencies in the Comdisco bankruptcy to look at Article 5.
But could you just go back first and answer Judge Rovner's question? Because your theory requires us to ignore the language in the plan that addresses recoveries in excess. And I don't know what you want those words to do, because we certainly are not going to be on firm ground if we start ignoring words in plans.
Your Honor, I would agree. I think Article 5 is the key provision that says how the C4 creditors are to be paid, and nowhere in the plan itself is there any mention or any suggestion whatsoever of an excess payment beyond 100% or a premium.
But then you're requiring us to throw away this whole these other documents that include the language that Judge Rovner just referred to, and that is something that both the bankruptcy court and the district court thought was contrary to the entire structure that the parties put together.
I don't think, Your Honor, frankly, we are asking you to ignore it entirely.
But how can we ignore it selectively?
Well, I would say in the first instance, we've laid out in our briefs a filing chronology, and it presents, I think, a very serious question that I encourage you to take a look.
We have looked at it, and you filed 2 weeks before.
Boy, have we looked at this. You owe me Thanksgiving. You too over there.
Your Honor, we do have extra turkey and cranberry. So even assuming that the court were and should consider this Exhibit C2 contingent distribution agreement,
Which was filed on July 15, 2002, 2 weeks before the confirmation order was entered.
But not attached to the plan.
Not stapled to it. Is there a stapling rule here?
Well, I think there's a common sense rule that says when you're asked to evaluate and vote upon a plan, that the provisions which would affect you would be plainly and clearly described and made available for you to review.
Why didn't that happen? The First Amendment joint plans filed on June 13. Then on July 15, before confirmation, this other thing is filed. Surely you don't have a policy of refusing to read anything that's been filed in the bankruptcy court after the plan is filed.
No, we don't, Your Honor. And, again, assuming that the court will consider that in deciding this appeal, I think it's very important to look at what the purpose of that exhibit C2 is, and the purpose of that exhibit is for the benefit of the Class C5A former shareholders of Condisco. That is the document that provides for the sharing agreement for the former shareholders to begin to accept and receive this 37%.
At the 85% level, but then there's sort of they get to share sooner than they would otherwise under the bankruptcy laws. And the quid pro quo is the C4 people continue to collect after they ordinarily would, right?
That would have been the quid pro quo. However, the trust beneficiaries in this instance are not very clearly, if you look at Section 11.3 of the trust, the beneficiaries of the trust. And the C2 agreement, the distribution agreement, is for their benefit. So I see a disconnect there that the appellees and the district court are relying upon the C2 agreement to say, look, somewhere buried in this plan there was a small mention of a possibility of an excess recovery, yet the document and the language they rely upon was not for their particular benefit. I think it's important to understand that structure.
I don't know why it's for the benefit of people who owe money, though. I mean, it certainly isn't for your client's benefit when they signed promissory notes promising to pay a full amount. How that gets distributed to various people who might have claims is of interest to those recipients, but the capacity in which your clients are here is that of people who need to pay money in, not people to whom money will be distributed.
We are here in that capacity. But at the time we filed our motion to terminate the Comdisco Litigation Trust, we also wore a second hat and were in the capacity of the Class C-5B subordinated claims relating to shares of stock in Comdisco. Remember, the SIP program was about shares of stock.
But you see, in that capacity, you should be wanting more money to be poured into the estate so that you can receive. You would not want to shut off a flow of funds.
I think in the particular instance here, Your Honor, where we are in effect wearing two hats, we made a conscious decision. We want to shut off the flow of funds here because we are in effect would be paying ourselves at the litigation trustee.
Only in part, though. That's the problem.
Right. And I think finally on this point, in respect to the C2 agreement, let's not forget that the confirmation order at paragraph 32 states that its provisions and its terms shall in all instances govern in the event of any inconsistency between the confirmation order and the plan.
Article Roman numeral 10.
Yes.
Provides that the trust continues until certain events occur, right?
Correct.
They're specified. Have they all occurred?
Those events have not occurred. The bankruptcy court has not ordered, obviously, the termination of the trust under the express termination provision in Article 10.
Isn't that a problem?
That is a problem. However, we have an answer to that problem, and the answer is that Illinois law in respect to trusts specifically allows Illinois Supreme Court cases we cite in our briefs to terminate a trust upon the fulfillment and completion of its purpose.
Even when the parties have otherwise specified what the termination events are?
Yes, Your Honor. The case in particular, Wood versus Continental Bank, dealt with a situation where there was not a fixed duration set forth in the trust, and the court there, the Illinois Supreme Court, held that even in that instance, when the trust purpose had been accomplished, as we believe it has been here in a larger sense involving payment to creditors, the court has the authority to terminate the trust. So notwithstanding the express termination provisions in Article 10, we believe that Illinois law will allow the bankruptcy court to terminate the trust.
Yeah, my recollection is there's some distinctions with that case. But anyway, okay.
Yeah. Wait a minute.
You can sit down if you're waiting for your rebuttal time.
Yes.
I think poor soul is waiting for
another question.
Us to find wood.
Oh.
I know I saw it, but you've misquoted it. You had it at page 26, and it isn't here.
It is factually distinguishable, as many of the trust cases are, because they involve testamentary trusts of a somewhat traditional nature, and of course this is a very unique trust under the bankruptcy code.
Well, we'll let either Ms. Perlman or Mr. Young respond, because our appellee brief says that Wood is at page 26.
But it isn't.
It is not.
Right.
24?
It's on 24, just as a quick cite. And in 24, I mean, I think it really does not stand for the proposition that you override particularly specified termination events. I think it covers cases with a much broader duration where the court's power can step in and announce that it's terminated.
Thank you. I will conclude for
save,
now.
Save. Okay. Thank you. Okay. You're first, Mr. Young. Do you want to go right to the last thought?
Certainly.
You want to go right to Wood? So
yeah, you're ahead on points. Don't kill it.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. In response to the questions about that case raised by both Judge Wood and by Judge Rovner, we agree that those cases can't carry the freight that the appellants are putting on them. Those cases seem to stand for the proposition that where no fixed duration is provided for the trust, that the court can step in, construe the instrument, and determine what an appropriate termination date would be. We think the more salient case, and it's cited in our papers, is LaSalle Bank versus McDonald, which holds that in the absence of a violation of the rule against perpetuities, and Judge Rovner, I apologize about our table of authorities. I think it went off a page or two. But if you look at page 24, that's where we cite it in the appellee's brief, and we cite it for the proposition that courts give effect to provisions of a trust agreement that establish duration, again, in the absence of some kind of deficiency like a violation of the rule against perpetuities. Even Wayman versus Follinsbee, which is the other Supreme Court of Illinois case on which the appellants rely so heavily.
That's the really old one, right?
Yeah, I think it's 1912.
Yeah.
Even Wayman versus Follinsbee.
Far away to me.
Even Wayman, Your Honors, does not stand for the proposition that you completely override the duration of the trust. What happened in Wayman was there were some beneficiaries who had vested property rights. There was a young man who was a beneficiary and wasn't supposed to get his corpus until he turned 25. And what the court did in Wayman was give the vested beneficiaries their interest, but continue the trust in effect as to the young man who had not reached 25. So even Wayman, which is one of the cases they rely on most heavily, doesn't stand for that proposition. Coates versus, I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
Coates versus Eldred, which is an even older Supreme Court case, and I think the start of this whole line of Illinois authority for the proposition that you stop a trust when it fulfills its purpose. Even Coates versus Eldred was a case that didn't provide for the kind of concrete trust termination provisions that, Judge Rovner, you noted are present in Article 10 of the trust agreement.
You know, the appellants are arguing that the negotiations that gave rise to the distribution agreement for the C4 and C5 creditors are not part of the record. First of all, is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that in the record below in the bankruptcy court there is some evidence of those negotiations, but it's almost of no moment, because what we have here is an interconnected plan structure that consists, as you observed in the prior questioning, of a plan, a confirmation order, and a variety of exhibits that include the trust agreement, the sharing threshold chart, and that distribution sharing agreement. All of those were the record that was approved and incorporated into the ruling that the bankruptcy judge made in 2002 when this plan was confirmed. So whether or not those discussions are in the record, the binding agreement and order that embodies them is properly before the court, I think beyond dispute. We're all talking about what it means. And it's our contention that those documents simply don't have the cap on recoveries that the appellants are urging. In fact,
but you know, it's a weird case here, because if your opponent is right, if Mr. Alsterda is correct that full compensation for these C4 creditors means present dollars, in effect an implicit interest adjustment, somebody on one side of this case or the other is going to get a windfall. Either will be his clients, the people who signed the promissory notes, who will be relieved of having to pay monies that they promised to pay, or it'll be the C4 creditors who, after getting present value compensation, will get more than that. Seems one way or the other, it's an odd situation.
The key to answering that question, Judge Wood, is to focus on the point in time in which the property rights given to the C4 creditors vested.
Well, I understand this argument that ex ante it was thought that perhaps it would only be at the 85-90% level, and collections proved to be more effective than maybe people thought they would be, and so forth. But where we sit right now, somebody or other is going to walk away with more than they thought they were due.
If I may, I think I still have to press that point the other way. Because what happens in the bankruptcy reorganization context is that you have a bundle of property rights, you have a group of intercreditor disputes, and the bankruptcy judge allocates everything, resolves the intercreditor disputes, and pursuant to a confirmed plan of reorganization, indicates to everybody how they go forward from that point. That occurred in the summer of 2002, and it occurred based upon a valuation the bankruptcy court made that, it was, as was noted in prior argument, put the estimated return to the C4 creditors somewhere between 88 and 90 cents on the dollar. Now, history has proven that that estimate was low, and it was treated in the findings and on the record as an estimate. Even the language in the confirmation order, paragraph AA, on which the appellants rely so heavily, refers to the finding being evidenced by the valuations and estimates contained in the disclosure statements and put into evidence at the confirmation hearing. So it ended up being more, but it could have ended up being less.
Sure. No, I understand that. Now, in the current world, though, or at least under this plan, I gather that having passed that 100% mark, the C5 people are still only getting, is it 38% of all recoveries in the
I think it's 37.
37, okay.
They get an additional distribution from Comdisco Holding Company cash that's indexed to the dollars that are collected and distributed by the litigation trust. But I'm glad you brought up the C-5s because it's very interesting to note their position in this dispute. And the prior questioning really focused on what capacity the appellants were acting in as they take these positions. If indeed this is really the mother of all 100% plus cases, you would think a well-represented equity committee, which this was, would have been pushing very hard to get all of the upside, all of the equity upside. That's not what happened. What happened is the deal was struck and memorialized in the plan where the equity holders got cashed in early, if you will. They started sharing somewhere around 85%, and in exchange for that, the C4s continued to share if they hit a liquidation home run and there was upside at the end of the road. And you know, to the point at the beginning of appellant's argument, the question raised about how you unwind this or where their position leads. Their position leads to just an unbelievable intercreditor dispute because we take the position the notes would not be discharged in the event this court ruled against us and terminated the trust.
So your position in answer to Judge Rovner's first question is those 67 cases would continue?
Yes, they would, although there would then be a fairly substantial dispute as to who would be the proper plaintiff, who would be the party in interest. And if you look at all the finality decisions that have come out of this court in the bankruptcy context, we've cited UNR. We also, I don't know if it's in the papers or not, but there's the Pence and Chappelle decisions. But it's exactly because 5 years down the road, you have these questions about who goes in what position and who gets what asset when you start unwinding confirmed, substantially consummated plans. It's exactly for that reason that the UNR court said, we don't want to do this. People rely on confirmed plans. There's actually a public market in the stock of Comdisco Holding Company, and all the reliance interests that are implicated in the UNR case are here as well. Thank you.
Ms. Pearl. Are you going to argue standing? What are you going to argue here?
I'm going to continue the discussion about the bankruptcy process, and I'm happy to address standing as well, if Your Honor is interested.
Well, I, you know, basically, you referred to the appellants as third parties with no stake in the outcome, and it seemed to me that that's just wrong because they would have standing to raise issues related to the termination of the trust. I mean, they are creditors, are they not?
Your Honor, they are to the extent that they are in Class C-5A, they are equity holders. The statute that they are raising in terms of the 100% recovery is 1129B, which
is... But under 1109B, isn't it 1109B?
That gives standing to parties in interest.
Right.
That is
correct.
Well,
I mean, if they're creditors, they can... raise and be heard and appear on any issue in a case under the entire chapter. So
that is correct, although there is some case law that limits that. And I would point to two different issues. The first of which is...
You are standing on your standing argument?
Your Honor, I believe that is correct. That is correct, Your Honor. We do not believe that they have standing. However, to the extent that they do have standing, we believe that the case law supports our position as well.
Is your position on the first of those points that if they were here as creditors, they would be making very different arguments, and so somehow they're here trying to sue themselves?
That is certainly part of our argument. Our argument would be, in the first instance, they did not object to the plan.
I mean, they really can't be on both sides of the case at the same moment.
That is correct, and that gets to the case law, and there's case law in this circuit. I believe it's the Wilson case, Your Honor, that to invoke a statute, one must be a party for whom the statute was intended to protect. Well, and the basis of their argument is 1129B, which is the cram-down statute, which was intended to protect Class C-5B, subordinated claims class. They are not in that class.
Are you saying they have no financial stake in the outcome of this bankruptcy?
They do have a financial stake in the outcome of the bankruptcy. They have a financial stake in two different ways. One way would be as an interest holder in C-5A, in which case their interest would be harmed if they were successful on appeal. The other financial stake they have is as a defendant in a litigation whose liability may disappear if they are successful. And I don't believe the standing statutes in the case law are intending to give them standing in that capacity.
And you just mean statutory standing. They obviously, in Article 3 sense,
yes,
have plenty of standing.
Yeah. That's correct, Your Honor. And, you know, as I said, that raises an important note in terms of this whole process. It is important to look at this process from the timing of confirmation. At confirmation, and actually going back prior to confirmation to follow on something that the appellant said earlier, this case is a case where the plan was based on a sharing arrangement that was reached by the Equity Committee and the Creditors Committee. The sharing arrangement solved a complex intercreditor dispute and avoided at the time of confirmation costly and protracted litigation. The first step in the confirmation process was providing notice to all parties. That was done through the disclosure statement, which was provided to all parties in interest, including the appellants. The disclosure statement stated in one of the introductory pages that after the holders of general unsecured claims had received over 100% recovery, holders of allowed interests in classes C-5A and 5B would receive 37% of all subsequent distributions.
So it used that word over 100%, and it made it clear that
it said it had received 100% distribution. It was the exact quote, and then they will receive 37% of subsequent distributions.
The implication being the other 63% was going to keep going to
absolutely
C4 people.
And in response to Judge Rogner's previous question, that same section of the disclosure statement went on to provide that sharing arrangement was reached because while the debtors did not believe there was equity value, the Equity Committee did, and in order to resolve the dispute, they reached this agreement. The disclosure statement also provided the debtors' valuation and projection information, which provided the foundation for the evidence it would present to the bankruptcy court later that the reasonable range of recoveries was from 88 to 90%, with a predicted recovery of 89.8%. In addition, Exhibit C-2 to the plan, which we referred to earlier, was filed in accordance with the exhibit filing date, which is a defined term in the plan, which provides that exhibits must be filed by a certain deadline, which we complied with and provided notice to parties prior to the voting deadline, as was referred to earlier. The debtors, after the disclosure statement was approved, solicited votes on this plan from over $4 billion worth of creditors and the holders of over 150 million shares of equity. Over 98% of those who voted in favor of the plan. The debtors then filed affidavits supporting their valuation and their projections. These affidavits were accepted into evidence by the bankruptcy court at the confirmation hearing, and the court made a finding that we complied with 1129B, specifically stating in the confirmation order at paragraph N that the debtors met their burden of proof with respect to 1129B by both the preponderance of the evidence and the clear and convincing evidence standard. Your Honor, the debtors believe that in this case, after that notice and evidence was presented, that finality is paramount. This court has held in multiple cases, Adair, Chappelle, Pence, Specialty Equipment, to name a few, the importance of finality. In UNR, this court focused on the importance of finality in a case where there are public securities. Here, over 150 million CDRs were distributed over 5 years ago. The value of these CDRs is indexed to the value of the distribution received by Class C4. This value is tied to the distributions from the litigation trust. These securities have been trading for over 5 years on the public markets based on this understanding of the valuation. Even the appellants in their reply concede that they're not trying to modify the sharing arrangement, as stated on page 4 of their reply. They state this: the sharing arrangement can remain in place except, and I quote, as long as, and I quote, as it has life outside the litigation trust. Your Honors, what the appellants are trying to do in this case is not prevent further distributions to C4, but rather prevent distributions from the trust, which is from their own liability. To understand the importance of finality in this case, you only need to look at the difference in addressing this issue now rather than a confirmation. As Your Honors raised earlier, if this is addressed now and the appellant's motion is granted, one of two things will happen. Either, as they suggest, the notes will disappear and they will walk from their own liability. Or, as the debtors argue, they will not be released from their liability, as the plan does not discharge them but specifically retains the liability, and there will be chaos and confusion resulting from this disintegration of the carefully constructed sharing arrangement that was at the center of this plan. If, however, the objection had been made at confirmation, one of two things would have been happening. Either the objection would have been overruled, as the debtors believe would have been the case, since we presented evidence showing the valuation in the range of 88% to 90%, and no one challenged that valuation. Or, if the objection at that point had been sustained, what would have happened is the debtors would have changed the plan at that point to modify the sharing arrangement so that it would provide a distribution that the bankruptcy court felt was in accordance with the bankruptcy code. In no event would the appellants have walked from their own personal liability. To allow the appellants to rework the distribution scheme now, 5 years after the effective date, would result in a monumental change in the bankruptcy process. It would allow the rights of parties in interest to be taken away after solicitation, confirmation, and substantial consummation of the plan. It would open up many cases already confirmed to future challenge. It would make it more difficult to confirm cases in the future, as you could not rely on the finality of the plan or res judicata of a confirmation order. And in this case, particularly, it would harm all parties in interest except for the appellants, and only in their capacity as defendants in litigation. And therefore, we respectfully ask this court to affirm the decisions of both the bankruptcy court and the district court and deny the appellant's motion to terminate the trust.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Elstead. How much?
Three and a half.
Thank you. To put matters in perspective, the distributions to date to unsecured creditors are approximately $3.8 billion on allowed claims of approximately $3.6 billion. So thus far, there has been a premium paid. In respect to the argument that there would be
of
this,
$2 million.
Yes, in excess.
200, 3.6 to 3.8 billion?
So
yes.
That's 200 million.
In respect to the argument that chaos and confusion would reign if the court were to direct the termination of the trust, respectfully, I suggest that is an overstatement. The C4 and C5 sharing arrangement could continue so long as Comdisco continues to wind up what few assets it has left. Their arrangement that was reached at confirmation would not be disturbed by the termination of the trust. In respect to the issue regarding estimation at the time of confirmation at 88% to 90%, I think the court has observed, and it's true, that this is a dynamic process. As events have played out, we are over 100%. We are not seeking a modification to this plan of reorganization too late in the game. What we have asked the bankruptcy court and this court to do is interpret the plan and the trust as written in light of actual circumstances as they occurred.
It's actually not that big a difference. It's 5% over, so it's I mean, the numbers sound like large numbers, but it's not particularly big.
Comdisco also has, Your Honor, additional cash that is yet to be distributed in, and I believe assets, so the recovery could indeed increase. Estimations, indeed, they were at the time of confirmation, but the bankruptcy court made the specific finding at paragraph AA that recoveries would not be more than in full. We believe that finding in the confirmation order is entitled to the same deference and respect and finality as any other provision in a confirmation order. When a court confirms a Chapter 11 plan, it has to make many, many findings to get to confirmation under Title 11, Chapter 11. We don't see how one finding or another finding should be any different than the paragraph AA finding. With respect to standing, Your Honor, the Seventh Circuit has held that if you are an aggrieved person, meaning you have a pecuniary financial interest in the outcome, you have standing to appeal an order of the bankruptcy court.
But you would agree that your standing flows from your capacity as a source of money for the estate, not your capacity as a potential recipient.
Correct. Yeah. And I think the standing...
I mean, you can't be suing yourself.
Right. And I think, as Your Honor pointed out, the standing is not so much Article III standing...
No, it's not Article III standing.
...or standing, an ability to rely upon a statute to make an argument, I think is what's at issue there. In respect to the argument that somehow vested investor interests, the C5A group, the former shareholders, would be disrupted, if you look at the record, it's very clear that early on in the case, Comdisco itself said any recoveries under this litigation trust would not be predictable or forecasted. Thank you, Your Honor. We request that the termination of the trust be directed upon remand.
Thank you to all parties. And, of course, the case will be taken under advisement. Thank you.